Right, thank you. After that slight technical hitch, let me welcome you to the first in a series of foreign policy analysis lectures hosted by the International Relations Department. My name is Toby Dodge. I am lucky enough to be a professor in the International Relations Department and director of the Middle East Centre. But more importantly, this series of lectures, I think, is designed to bring foreign experts, academics on foreign policy analysis to the International Relations Department, but not just any experts, experts who have two qualifications. One is they're innovative and well-known within the field, and two, they play a central role in both our undergraduate teaching, IR202, and our postgraduate teaching, IR411. And I think Jeffrey fulfills both those. I think after he teaches political science, but international relations and foreign policy analysis at Tufts University, has a PhD from Harvard. His first book, Balance and Risk, Great Power Intervention in the Periphery, Cornell, 2004. What my students, our students on IR411 will know is the co-edited volume, along with Lobel and Richman, Neoclassical Realism, the State and Foreign Policy. And I think what a lot of us all know is the book published this year by Oxford University Press, Neoclassical Realism, Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics, which a lot of us have consumed, are in the present state of consuming. Jeff will talk for, he says 35 minutes, let's take a bet it might be 40 minutes, and then we'll go to questions and answers. So, without any ado, sir?
Well, thank you. I'm going to stand, if that is all right, because that's what I'm used to doing when I teach back in the United States. First, let me thank you for your hospitality and thank Professor Dodge for inviting me to speak as part of the Foreign Policy Lecture Series. It really is an honor for me to be here, and it is a real privilege to be able to speak to you about my work and about this book, Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics. What I'm going to do is to provide an overview of what Noren Ripzmann, Stephen Lobel, and I try to accomplish in the book. And I'm going to organize the talk as follows. First, I'm going to talk about the main objectives that we set forth in this particular volume. Then I'm going to speak a little bit about neoclassical realism's conception of the international system, as well as its conception of states as the primary actors within the international system. From there, I'm going to talk about the transition from what we term type 1 neoclassical realism, or theories of foreign policy anomalies or foreign policy mistakes, to type 2 neoclassical realism, theories of general foreign policy behavior, to type 3 neoclassical realism, theories of international outcomes. I will touch a bit on epistemology and methodology and research design, and then we will open up the floor for questions and answers. I'm happy to talk about, during that period, the areas of convergence and divergence between neoclassical realism and other approaches or schools of international relations theories, such as constructivism, to the extent we can think of constructivism as a school of international relations theories and not just as an ontological position, liberalism, the foreign policy analysis literature, the FPE literature, as well as the different variants of liberalism and, of course, structural realism. I'm also happy to talk about where I think the future of neoclassical realist research happens to be going, and I'll talk about, if you'd like, some of my own work on intra-alliance coercion and non-proliferation. Stephen Noren and I set out six main objectives in this book. The first and the most important is to set forth and organize neoclassical realism as a research agenda in the study of international relations. We conceive of neoclassical realism as a broad family of theories, not as a unitary theory. The second objective is to provide a systematic treatment of the different domestic level, to provide a systematic treatment of neoclassical realism's independent variables, that is, causal variables at the systemic level, and its unit level or domestic level intervening variables. The third objective is to expand the scope of the dependent variables or outcomes that neoclassical realist theories purport to explain, from simply foreign policy anomalies to broad patterns of international outcomes. The fourth is to distinguish neoclassical realism from other theoretical approaches in IR, particularly other approaches that identify variables at multiple levels of analysis or that draw insights from multiple approaches. We spend a good deal of time, especially in chapter 5, which is the longest chapter in the book, discussing epistemology, methodology, and research design for neoclassical realism. We wrote that chapter specifically with PhD students and younger scholars in mind. And then finally, we try to demonstrate the value added by developing our own different neoclassical realist theories and trying to illustrate how those particular theories can resolve some long-standing debates in both the security studies and the political economy wings of the IR literature. So those are our main objectives in this book. Let me tell you a little bit about the origins of this project. Norman, Stephen, and I were introduced in the early 2000s. We were introduced at a meeting of the International Studies Association by Ben Franklin, who was the founding editor of the journal Security Studies. And we began talking about our mutual interest in neoclassical realism at the ISA meeting in Portland, Oregon, in March of 2003. And that was significant for two reasons. Number one, the United States was on the precipice of invading Iraq. And number two, I went home with a case of walking pneumonia. So I remember those meetings quite well for that reason. The result of that particular meeting was our decision to try to organize a conference, which was eventually held at Concordia University in Montreal, bringing together other IR scholars from North America to try to think about how this body of literature that Gideon Rhodes called neoclassical realism in a 1998 review article in the journal World Politics, how it might illuminate different aspects of state-society relations in the making of foreign policy. And so in putting together that volume, we tasked a group of contributors to think about different questions about how this approach, which Rhodes had seen as a sort of a response to the extreme structural, systemic focus of Waltzian structural realism, how we could think about the relationships between state and society, the interplay between different parts of the state apparatus in the making of foreign policy. Now, in Rose's original review article, he was reviewing the first books of Randall Schweller, Thomas Christensen, William Woolforth, and Fareed Zakaria, back when Zakaria was an academician. He conceived of neoclassical realism as mainly an approach to explaining foreign policy behavior that was anomalous from the standpoint of structural realism, specifically from the standpoint of Kenneth Waltz's systemic version of balance of power theory. And in our 2009 edited volume, we took that as a starting point. How do domestic politics within states impede the optimal response of the state to systemic imperatives? We claim in that particular book that neoclassical realism was an addendum to structural realism. It falls within the same family of theories. It's not a repudiation of structural realism, but rather it's a qualification of structural realism. And toward that end, we maintained the dichotomy that Kenneth Waltz adopted 25 years earlier, between theories of international outcomes, that is, theories which abstract from the internal components of units, i.e. states primarily, and focus on explaining a small number of big and important things about the general dynamics of international politics on the one hand, and theories of foreign policy or foreign policy behavior on the other hand. That was our starting point in neoclassical realism, the state and foreign policies. Well, in the ensuing years, we continued our conversation, we continued our collaboration, we produced a second co-edited volume, this one called The Challenge of Grand Strategies, The Great Powers and the Broken Balance Between the World Wars, which looked at the grand strategic choices of the five major powers in the years between 1919 and roughly 1939-1941. And in doing that project, we recognized a couple of things. First, the dividing line between neoclassical realism and other theoretical approaches, in particular analytic eclecticism, constructivism, the foreign policy analysis, and even literature and even liberalism, wasn't clear. It certainly wasn't clear in the minds of many IR scholars. The second realization that we came to was that neoclassical realism was continually being criticized by structural realists, as well as others, as just being an ad hoc, random grab bag of unit-level intervening variables. Oh, states do not balance in a timely or efficient manner, they don't arm themselves in response to predatory neighboring powers. Let's see what domestic level variable can I identify to explain this particular anomaly. Another problem that Nora and Stephen and I foresaw was that there were some fundamental disagreements among people who were adopting the neoclassical realist moniker over questions of methodology and epistemology. People were saying, well, neoclassical realism is really just an attempt by constructivists to adopt the realist label. These people really aren't realists, they're constructivists, they just don't want to admit that they're constructivists. Well, this chart was actually made to me at a particular conference that I was attending. I was also giving a paper at the same conference about the outbreak of the Pacific War, and somebody accused me of being the last Japanese imperialist, which was rather odd. But there were some fundamental disagreements over methodology and over epistemology. A fourth conclusion that we came to gradually over the course of several years was that Waltz's dichotomy between theories of international outcomes and theories of international politics was distinctly unhelpful. It was, in effect, a way of stifling debate. Waltz's theory of international politics remains, 3 years after his death, the most cited and the most criticized work in international relations theory over the past 60 years. And Waltz had set out a pretty clear agenda of what he wanted to do in that particular book. And everyone who read that book, or everyone who claimed to have read that book, but instead only read somebody else's review article about that book, has a very, very strong view over what Waltz did or did not mean to do in that book. One of the criticisms that Waltz tried to counter was, well, your theory is looking only at the system. It's only looking at the polarity, the number of great powers in the system, or the distribution of power at its largest, highest level of aggregation. What does this actually say about foreign policy? And Waltz responded, well, my theory makes no claims to explaining the foreign policy behavior of particular states. It can't tell you what the United States is likely to do in this situation or that situation. And then about 6 months later, he would write a piece saying, the United States ought to do this, that, and the other thing with respect to NATO. Well, if you don't have a theory of foreign policy, if you can't embed a theory of foreign policy into your systemic framework that purports to explain international outcomes, then why exactly are you making these normative pronouncements about what the United States ought or ought not to do with respect to a particular problem, whether it's adjusting to the demise of the Soviet Union or trying to figure out how to deal with the impending rise of China. Didn't make very much sense to us. And the final thing that we grappled with was our growing recognition that neoclassical realism might actually be able to explain a far broader range of phenomena than we had thought about, than we had considered originally in 2007, 2008, when we began working on the first edited book. That it might be more than just an attempt to account for anomalies for structural realist theories, and that it could actually be useful in explaining patterns of international outcomes. Which brings me to the first visual image. This is a parabola. Figure relative causal importance of systemic and domestic level variables. This appears in the book itself. At one asymptote, we have systemic determinism. That is the notion that it is the international system, the external environment, that determines the behavior of the units within the environment. That states, agents, have very few choices. At the other extreme, the other asymptote, we have domestic determinism, complete agency on the part of units, on the part of states. Well, those are two extreme positions. We contend that the bulk of international politics, that is, most of the phenomena that we here in this room are interested in knowing something about, theorizing about, actually fall in the middle. And it's our contention that the causes of units' behavior and the outcomes of the choices that units make, the aggregation of the choices that units make, fall in this middle area. Hence, the label is primarily systemic, but moderated by unit-level or domestic-level intervening variables. Now, I want to move on and talk a little bit about how we, Nora and Stephen and I, as neoclassical realists, conceive of the international system, and where we build upon and where we diverge from structural realists like Kenneth Walt, but also people like Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, Barry Posen to some extent, and others in the North American Academy or School of Political Realism or Structural Realism. Just a brief note about terminology. In the book, we prefer the term structural realism rather than neorealism. Rick Ashley coined the term neorealism specifically in reference to Waltz's theory of international politics in a review article published in International Organization back in 1983. And the label stuck. The reason we prefer the term structural realism is that it better identifies the causal variable in this body of theory than neorealism. The other rationale for using structural realism is we kept switching between neorealism and neoclassical realism. Well, the alliteration becomes a bit tiresome after about four or five chapters. Structural realism begins with the supposition that we exist in an anarchic international system, that is, an international system in which there is no world government, no overarching authority above the level of the units that comprise the system and whose interactions spontaneously and unintentionally generate that system. That because this is an anarchic international system, the fundamental problem for all states is one of uncertainty, about one another's present and, more importantly, future intentions, and that the main determinant of international bargaining outcomes and of individual states' behavior is the relative distribution of capabilities, defined largely in terms of material capabilities. Well, that's a fine starting point. Indeed, much of the structural realist literature pays a tremendous amount of attention to the number of great powers there happen to be in an international system at any given time, or the polarity of the system. that is a particular fixation among American IR scholars and has been for the past 40, 50 years. Polarity, polarity, polarity versus bipolarity, bipolarity versus multipolarity, and for the past dozens or so years, unipolarity and how long unipolarity is going to last. And that's a starting point. We argue that it's an incomplete picture of what the international system is. Yes, the relative distribution of power defined in terms of material capabilities is important. Yes, material capabilities are not synonymous with international outcomes in any way, shape, or form. It's different from influence, clearly. But we argue that there are some other systemic variables that are also important in trying to explain the behavior of individual states and patterns of international outcomes that result from their interactions. The first of these is what we term systemic clarity. Systemic clarity has three subcomponents. First, the degree to which a state's external threats or opportunities are readily discernible to the members of its foreign policy executive, that is, the top leaders of the state who are actually charged with the formulation of foreign and defense policies and foreign economic policy in many circumstances. Second, whether or not the international system provides information about the time horizons or time frames in which those threats or opportunities are likely to manifest themselves or materialize. And third, whether or not an optimal strategic response to those threats or those opportunities happens to stand out to the members of the foreign policy executive. The second variable which we introduce is something that we refer to as the nature of a state's strategic environment. Every state in the international system faces its own strategic environment. We use that term to refer to the content of the information that the system is providing that state. We conceive of a continuum, an idealized continuum, between a restrictive strategic environment and a permissive strategic environment for any given state, depending upon the imminence and the magnitude of the external threats or the external opportunities that state faces at any given point in time. The example which Noren and Stephen love to use in the book, much to my consternation, of the ultimate restrictive strategic environment for a state is the period in May and early June of 1967, after Egyptian President Anwar Sadat demanded the removal of UN peacekeepers from the Suez Canal zone and the straits, and closed the Straits of Tiran to international shipping, and after Israeli intelligence began picking up overwhelming information that a coordinated offensive by Egypt and Syria was not only possible, but extremely likely and indeed imminent in the next several weeks. And the argument which we make in the book is that, well, in that type of system, in that type of strategic environment, the type of information that the environment was providing to Levi Eshkol's cabinet and to the IDF staff was abundant. This was an imminent threat. Now, the broader theoretical point is that we conceive of this strategic, a state strategic environment as existing along a continuum. And it is a contextual continuum. The more imminent and the larger the external threats or opportunities the state confronts, the more restrictive its strategic environment will be. Conversely, the more remote and the smaller those external threats or opportunities the state confront, the less restrictive or the more permissive a strategic environment that state happens to face. Different states can be in different or face different strategic environments at the same time. So in a sense, it's peculiar to a particular state, but it is primarily systemic. So the types of things that would make a restrictive strategic environment, or would constitute a restrictive strategic environment for a small, vulnerable state with no strategic depth like Israel in the 1967 war, are not the types of things, not the types of threats and opportunities that would constitute a restrictive strategic environment for a state like the United States in the 20-teens, or whatever we happen to be calling this decade. I want to move on, though, and talk a bit about this distinction that Nora and Stephen and I make among, oh, actually, before I do so, I want to say a few words about our conception of the state. Before I move on to different types of realism. In the 2009 edited volume, Neoclassical Realism, the State and Foreign Policy, we talk quite a bit about the state, but I think it's worth highlighting some different aspects of the state. Unlike structural realism, which tends to treat the state as a black box and tends to assume that those in charge of the state, particularly those in charge of the national security apparatus, can easily and quickly mobilize societal resources or obtain political consent in order to gain the resources or the political legitimacy needed to pursue their preferred foreign and security policies, we say that actually that's a gross oversimplification. For our purposes, neoclassical realism rests on a top-down conception of the state. We spend a lot of time talking about what we term the Foreign Policy Executive, or FPE, which we define as the top officials in a state who are actually charged with the formulation and, in many cases, the execution of foreign and security policies on behalf of the state. These officials, in a sense, are akin to the Roman god Janus, the god of transitions, portals, and doorways, in that they have one face that is facing outward into the international system, but another face which is facing inward toward domestic politics. The members of any state's FPE have privileged information about foreign threats and opportunities, information that other societal actors do not have, but they never have complete agency, even in autocratic or totalitarian political systems, to move resources around and to respond quickly to external events, except in crisis settings. Instead, when it comes to day-to-day foreign policy decision-making or longer-term grand strategic adjustment, they have to be engaged in a political game. They have to bargain with other societal actors. They have to mobilize and extract resources from domestic society. They have to maintain some level of, if not popular support, then at least buy-in among principal stakeholders in order to pursue the strategies which they believe will enhance the security of their states. Now, I want to move on, though, briefly, to this discussion of type 1 and type 2 and type 3 neoclassical realism. This is a chart which, again, appears in the book. This is a sort of a schematic representation of what we mean by type 1 and type 2 neoclassical realism. We begin with the supposition that what's ultimately driving, what is ultimately causing a state's foreign policy behavior, whether aberrant or not, is its reaction to stimuli from the international system. The basic causal arrow runs from systemic stimuli through perceptions of the top leaders of the state, a decision-making process, policy implementation, to particular policy responses without any feedback loops. Now, as I said, type 1 neoclassical realism was basically a theory of, or set of theories about foreign policy mistakes, generally focusing on inefficient or suboptimal alliance formation or armament behavior in the face of rising external threats, sometimes existential threats. Type two, neoclassical realism, were more general types of foreign policy theories, but theories which made no claim to explain international bargaining outcomes. What we are proposing in this particular volume is type three, neoclassical realism. And I'm going to walk you through this diagram. What's doing the causing here is, again, systemic stimuli. Relative distribution of power, the degree of systemic clarity, the type of strategic environment the state happens to find itself in any given time. And of course, systemic stimuli, as Rose stated in his 1998 review article, systemic variables can only affect foreign policy behavior through the medium of the actual flesh and blood human beings charged with making foreign and security policy. I believe that's a direct quote. And can only operate through the subjective assessments and perceptions or misperceptions of top leaders. What we do in this particular book is to try to group the disparate unit-level variables or domestic intervening variables that other neoclassical realists have identified over the years into four broad categories and to specify the circumstances under which they are more likely to moderate the effect of that systemic stimuli on the strategic responses of the states. So we group them into four broad categories. The first are leader images, and these can refer to a whole set of cognitive or affective psychological variables or biases, belief systems that are held by individuals or small groups that skew in some way the evaluation of information about the external environment, which may predispose officials for or against particular responses. The second is strategic culture, collective sets of belief systems held by larger groups of individuals or embedded in the bureaucratic organizations which are charged with making foreign and defense policy, which highlight particular aspects of problems, downplay other aspects of problems, view certain responses as legitimate, and delegitimate other potential responses. The third category of variables refer to state-society relations. This is not just a categorization of different types according to regime, democracy, non-democracy, or democracy, partial or illiberal democracy, to use Zakaria's term, and autocracy, but rather patterns of relationships between the central institutions of government and different actors within society, different interest groups, and the extent to which those groups outside the state apparatus have either veto power or can make their influence felt in trying to modulate or shape the actual policies that the state apparatus pursues abroad. And the final are domestic institutions. These refer to the types of bureaucratic mechanisms which are available to states to mobilize and to extract resources from society. Systems of taxation, systems of mobilization of human power, manpower, people power, in the pursuit of particular foreign policy objectives. And we try to specify the circumstances under which, or the conditions under which, each one of these categories of intervening variables is going to be more or less important. Now, moving from what would be my or your left, right words, leader images and strategic culture are going to tend to be more consequential in short-term types of interactions. When we move further to the left, then state-society relations and domestic institutions become more consequential. The final part of the graph I want to highlight is this part in which policy responses are linked to international outcomes. A single state's foreign and security policy cannot create an international outcome. International outcome, as I define it, as Nora and Stephen define it, is the result of the aggregation of the different choices that particular states make. Now, during the seminar for the PhD students this afternoon, a question arose as to how do we know an international outcome when we observe it? What exactly constitutes an international outcome? And that's very hard to say a priori. There's certain types of international outcomes which are quite obvious to people even when they're taking place. A state loses a war and is occupied by a foreign power. Well, that's a pretty clear international outcome. Or the result of a bargaining round regarding, a climate change treaty. That's a type of international outcome, even though the implementation of that treaty and whether or not that treaty actually succeeds in reducing global carbon emissions is something that may or may not be within the parameters of what the particular author is studying and may be more difficult to discern from an analytical standpoint. But our point here is that there is actually a feedback mechanism, a twofold feedback mechanism. If international outcomes are always the result of the aggregation of strategies which different states pursue, different actors pursue in international politics, then what those actors can and cannot subsequently do at later points in time are shaped by prior international outcomes. Not determined, but shaped. Because again, much of international politics exists in that midpoint, that mid-range between the two asymptotes. So here we have, and I'm particularly proud of this one because I drew it myself. Here we have a nice conceptual scheme of the three types of neoclassical realism. On one axis, we have the level of analysis of the dependent variable, that is the phenomena that the researcher seeks to explain, outcome. And on the other axis, we have the temporal range of the dependent variable. That is the time frame under which we would expect that particular outcome to be manifest. Type 1, neoclassical realism, theories of foreign policy mistakes. Notice the smallest circle doesn't have a fairly high level of aggregation in terms of the dependent variable. Scholars are mainly interested in explaining anomalous episodes in particular states' foreign and security policies. Moreover, these scholars are generally focused on short-term decision-making. Days, weeks, sometimes years, but certainly not several years, certainly not decades, certainly not centuries. Type 2 neoclassical realism, the larger circle embedded within the two and larger oval embedded within the two, is a more general approach to explaining foreign policy behavior. It, too, does not purport to explain international political outcomes, but the time frame is somewhat broader. As we state in the book, an example of type 2 neoclassical realism would be Colin Dueck's first book about American grand strategic adjustment during the Cold War, or during World War I, or after World War I, the Cold War, and then immediately after the Cold War. But again, that body of neoclassical realist theory does not purport to explain international outcomes. Type 3 neoclassical realism does. Now, I want to say a bit about the epistemology and the methodology of neoclassical realism before opening it up to questions and answers. First, Norman, Stephen, and I don't take any particular positions on the broader ways about meta-theory and about the philosophy of science and the philosophy of the social sciences. As we like to say, all three of us are lactose intolerant. We don't really take a very strong stand about Karl Popper and the notion of falsification. We certainly aren't Hoodians. But we did want to address questions of epistemology. We are historically oriented by our scholars. Each of us spend a tremendous amount of time, doing archival research to explain the grand strategic choices of particular states. We believe that international relations theory, if it is to be useful in explaining phenomena that we want to explain, has to engage empirical data. And we believe that qualitative methods are the best way as a method for us to address the questions that are interested in us. But in terms of epistemology, we begin with the supposition that there actually is an objective world out there, a world that exists independently of our conceptions of it or our intersubjective understandings of it, and that we can learn something about the properties of that world, however imperfectly. We believe that competitive hypothesis testing using empirical data is a worthwhile endeavor. Indeed, it's necessary for us to address some of the questions that we're interested in explaining. That said, we recognize that international relations will never, never replicate the physical sciences. We can't run true experimental designs. Oh, let's have one world in which World War I did not happen, and another world in which it did happen, and a world in which it happened, but Germany and Austria-Hungary were on the winning side. We can't do that very well. Well, we can do it with counterfactual thought experiments, but that has its limitations. It does have its limitations, with all respects to Richard Ned Lebeau and others who work in counterfactual thought experiments. And finally, the best we can hope to do is to generate theories which yield probabilistic hypotheses and not deterministic hypotheses. Now, in terms of methodology, as I've said, we embrace qualitative and multi-method research design in our own work. We adhere very strongly to Clifford Geertz and James Mahoney's notion of the causes of effects approach to explanation. That is, we want to create theories that have well-defined scope positions, well-defined scope conditions, and which purport to explain variation across each and every last one of the cases that we have selected, ideally, keeping in mind that there will always be anomalies that a particular hypothesis will encounter. We call for identifying structural realist baselines for particular neoclassical realist theories, whether those baselines are derived from balance of power theory or from hegemonic theory or power preponderance theories. It doesn't matter, just as long as the researcher can explain what his or her or their chosen structural realist baseline is a priori. And we also address the question of how the neoclassical realist researcher might go about identifying the appropriate cluster of intervening variables. We outline both a deductive approach and an inductive approach. We talk a great deal about clarifying scope conditions for particular NCR theories and specifying the scope and the membership of a particular state's FPE. And then much of Chapter 5 addresses questions of data gathering and analysis. Now, finally, let me just conclude my formal remarks with one observation about the title of the book, Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics. This came up during the lunch seminar, and actually Nick Kitchen raised it. Why did you call this book Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics if what you are purporting to do is to create a broad framework or school of theories? To which I answered, without any degree of irony or gall on my part, would you have bought a book called Neoclassical Realist Approaches to International Politics and Foreign Policy? We adopted this title in part as a homage to Waltz's theory of international politics. We adopted it in part because it could very easily fit on a book jacket. But we are quite clear from the outset that we do not envision, not now, not ever, that neoclassical realism has been or ever will be a single unitary theory. We view it as a family of theories. theories which begin with shared assumptions and a commitment to a common epistemology and common methodology. NCR is not a single theory any more than liberalism is a single theory, or the English school is a single theory, or foreign policy analysis is a single theory, or structural realism itself is a single theory. Kenneth Waltz is not the only structural realist. Never has been, never was. There are a plurality of NCR theories, and that is how it should be. So I thank you, and I welcome your questions, but I do want to take a drink of water first.
Thank you, Jeff, for that thought, of course. I note without a single lecture note, I'm deeply envious about that. And a huge horizon scanned and a lot to discuss. Have we got any questions to start us off? Well, while you're gathering your thoughts, I think I better leap in. If we could go back to slide 8, which is the mother of all slides in this deck, I would have thought. Yeah, so there it is.
This is the mother of all slides.
I think so, the mother of all slides.
I have to tell Nora that, since he was the one who did this.
Well, it reminds me, I think, of debates in Althusserian Marxism, actually.
I definitely have to tell Nora.
Because, of course, Althusser coined the phrase in the last instance, so structure determines in the last instance. And he was accused, I suspect, by other less thoughtful or complex Marxists, of holding on to the last instance because that's the justification of his Marxism. So the mode of production determines in the last instance. And I'm struck by your strategic stimuli, which would be your claim to causality and your claim to realism. But then in the sausage factory of empirical reality, it gets cut up a lot by an awful lot of things. If you could take us through that again, but with the causal centrality of your justification to be realist. Because I know you're a bit grumpy that you're accused of being a constructivist. We have an awful lot getting in the way before the outcome. And I wonder if, as with Althusserian Marxism, this is there just to keep you on the realist straight and narrow, but by the time it pops out the other end, it's been hacked about a lot, especially by perception.
Well, I think this is a charge which we've encountered, which I've encountered for the past 15 years. And I do have to say, I do have good friends who are constructivists. I do hang around Dan Nixon and Spanish Jackson. I actually like them. And they are good friends, and I think very, very well of them. But we just fundamentally agree to disagree on questions of ontology. What is doing the causing of any state's behavior is the distribution of power, as well as the degree of systemic clarity and the type of strategic environment that the state, or more properly its FP, finds itself in any given instance. We're pretty clear, or at least I think we are pretty clear in the book, that these intervening variables, whether these are the ideational intervening variables such as leader images or strategic culture, or the more materialist intervening variables such as state-society relations and domestic institutions, do not have any independent causal force on the state's foreign and security policy, let alone patterns of international outcomes, but rather serve as forces which might mediate the impact of structural variables. Ultimately, foreign policy decisions, foreign policy choices are being made by a relatively select group of individuals at the top of any state's apparatus who are responding, we argue, we assume, to their external environment first and foremost. And that is, in a sense, an untestable assumption. Just as the assumptions which underlie liberal or pluralist models of foreign policy make the untestable assumption that leaders are primarily concerned with appeasing their domestic constituents and continuing their tenure in office above all else without any regard to what's going on externally. But we begin with that supposition. Now, there are critics, whether they are constructivists or foreign policy analysis proponents or structural realists, who will argue that, well, by opening up the black box of the state and by saying that things like the types of institutional arrangements which happen to exist in a particular state, or the types of strategic ideas, cultural ideas, which are embedded in things like military doctrine, or grand strategic policy statements, or the role of affective or cognitive variables on individual or small group decision making. By even considering that, you're stepping automatically outside of the bounds of realism and instead incorporating variables which were properly associated with liberalism or constructivism or the foreign policy analysis literature, etc. And I have two responses to that. Number one, none of those bodies of theory or schools of theory which I just mentioned pay very much attention to what's going on in the external environment. They may give lip service to it. Oh yes, we acknowledge power is important. Oh yes, we live in an anarchic international system. Oh yes, and then here I am paraphrasing Robert Cohan in After Hegemony, on the basis of their own pessimistic assumptions, I purport to show that traditional pessimism that realists have about the prospects of international cooperation are not warranted, but then considerations of relative power completely drop out of his functional theory of regimes. Completely. Constructivists may talk about the international system, but if the international system is not a reality, it's entirely the product of intersubjective understanding on the part of actors and therefore malleable, then that's really a question of ontology, not so much a debate about theoretical assumptions, at least as I understand ontology and theoretical assumptions. If we are arguing that states are strategic actors, or rather those who act on their behalf are strategic actors, who are concerned primarily about what's going on outside the borders of the state, then I contend we very much are realists. Now, I do hope that we can avoid some of the, to quote your current Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, what was it, you called it the Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guinea style orgies of cannibalism and sheep killing. He said this about the Conservative Party, and people were aghast because he had, Papua New Guinea in it, but it was actually a pretty accurate description of the Conservative Party for much of the 25 years. But it's also a pretty accurate description of debates among Marxists. If we can avoid that as self-described neoclassical realists, I think that would be a very good thing. He also wrote a very obscene poem about Recep Tayyip Erdogan, which I won't repeat.
We have a question. We have a question from Professor Margot Light.
Hi. Yes, your talk was fascinating, and thank you very much. And I too was terribly impressed by the absence of any notes. In this model, you suggested that which of the intervening variables are important depends upon the time limit. I think you said
yes.
So can you take us through them? Because you said if it's short term, then the leader images will be very important. I assume there's not one leader, but the leaders in this foreign policy executive. If we have a longer term problem that is being responded to, does leader image cease to matter, and do the other intervening variables come in, or do they? You just add the new intervening variables depending upon the length of time you have to respond?
That's a very good question. I'm going to move over here to try to illustrate this graphically. When we talk about leader images, we're talking about the calculations, the perceptions of the members of the foreign policy executive. The composition of every state's foreign policy executive is generally, it can vary. It can be several, maybe a dozen people, sometimes it can be several dozen people, depending on the particular state. But rarely are foreign policy decisions made by a single individual. When we talk about leader images being the important category of intervening variables in the short run, we're mainly saying that with respect to decisions which require an immediate response, an imminent threat of invasion, for example, a true crisis setting, there simply isn't enough time for the members of the FPE to consult other societal actors. there simply is not enough time for broader patterns of politics within the state to come into play to try to shape the type of response that state may or may not take to that particular threat or that opportunity. Now, as we move temporally towards other types, towards explaining other types of phenomena which are likely not going to unfold over the course of hours, days, maybe a week or two or three, but rather are going to unfold over the course of months or a year or several years, then the relevant analysis or the relevant unit of analysis shifts. Yes, the FPE is still important, but a broader range of actors within the state apparatus and within society itself are going to be far more important in determining how that state would likely respond to that particular systemic stimuli, whether it's a threat or an opportunity. That doesn't mean that leader images completely vanish, but as the time frame increases, as the time frame extends, other types of domestic dynamics become a bit more consequential in shaping the type of response. In other words, let me try to give you an empirical example. I've been thinking quite a bit lately about Harry Truman and about the origins of U.S. Cold War grand strategy in the late 1940s, the origins of what came to be known as containment. If one were to think about Truman's initial reaction to the Great Civil War and to Soviet pressure on the Turkish Straits in the winter of 1946, then I would say, well, we have to look at his perceptions, his misperceptions, the role of cognitive or affective variables in understanding how Truman and George Marshall and James Forrestal, after summer of 47, James Forrestal and others were evaluating the situation, how it's delimiting the range of acceptable or unacceptable strategies to try to deal with that particular crisis. But if we extend the time frame a bit more and say, well, I'm not just interested in explaining your initial reaction to Turkish demands, to Soviet demands for free access to the Turkish Straits. And we're not just looking at their initial reaction or trying to explain their initial reaction to Soviet support for the Greek communists in the Civil War. We want to explain how Truman and his administration came about developing what became known as the Truman Doctrine, why the Truman Doctrine took the form that it did, why the European Recovery Program took the form that it did, as opposed to other alternatives, which were equally plausible based simply on just an analysis of the distribution of power as it existed in 1947. Then we need to bring in strategic culture and state-society relations. If we were to expand the time frame a bit more, and here I'm going to reference a little read, but I think critically important book by Aaron Friedberg, In the Shadow of the Garrison State in 2000. If we want to explain this broader pattern of grand strategic adjustment by the United States, why the United States not only pursued a strategy of containment, but developed particular types of mechanisms to harness its technological advantages, to extract financial and human resources from society, to produce armaments in order to deal with this external threat, then we need to look at state-society relations and domestic institutions, keeping in mind that leader images and strategic culture were always working there in the background as mediating systemic stimuli. But keeping in mind that in order to explain this broader pattern of extractive and mobilization choices, or what Friedberg called the grand strategic bargain, which was struck in the 1940s and in the 1950s especially, you have to look at these other two categories, the intervening variables. Have I answered your question? Thank you. I didn't mean to talk on at length.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I wonder, I wonder if there is an implicit contradiction in your book. As in this book and in today's wonderful speech, you claim that you're trying to, or type 3 new classical realism is trying to go beyond the structural realist paradigm. Mm-hmm. However, when it comes to the research strategy as proposed in this book, you explicitly state that we should begin with the structural realist baseline. Then you still kind of add in more variables, more complexity to the structural realism. So is this a contradiction?
Well, first of all, I don't see it as a contradiction because I don't see us as adding variables to structural realism. One of our explicit objectives in this book was to differentiate neoclassical realism from structural realism. In our earlier works, we said that neoclassical realism is the natural addition to structural realism, it's a continuation of structural realism, it is a better specification of structural realism. Mm-hmm. And in this book, we explicitly say, no, neoclassical realism is its own research program. Structural realism can do what structural realism does or what it purports to do, but we're not going to claim that we're merely subsidiary to it and interested in improving it. Now, the reason why we suggest starting with a structural realist baseline for neoclassical realist research is actually quite realpolitik and pragmatic on our part. Because every time we submitted a manuscript for review, for publication, someone would write back, well, couldn't structural realism explain this just as well without recourse to all of these intervening variables? So by starting explicitly from the starting point, say, this is what structural realism would have us expect in this particular aspect, or in this particular instance. Or more precisely, this is what a particular structural realist theory or hypothesis would expect. We can sort of short-circuit that type of argument, that line of attack. Now, I said during lunch, I believe in response to a question which you raised during lunch. It is entirely possible, since neoclassical realism posits these intervening variables, to also have a baseline that's derived from the foreign policy analysis literature, or from liberalism. And I stated explicitly, I believe it was in response to a question that Gustav raised, that it is entirely possible to have a structural realist baseline that is not derived from Waltz's balance of power theory. I know that in my own current book project, my baseline is not derived from Waltz's balance of power theory. It's derived from power preponderance or hegemonic theory. I think, though, you're getting at a broader question, and one that I'm only beginning to grapple with in my own work. There has always been a tension in the American approach to political realism, beginning with Morgenthau in the 1940s, this tension between the normative pronouncements and aspirations of political realists, many of whom were bitterly critical of foreign policy, American foreign policy in particular, but also British foreign policy and French foreign policy. The normative strand of it, this is what states ought to do, versus the empirical strand, this is what states are actually doing. And a question which has arisen in a number of different venues is that, well, structural realism and structural realist theories, whether it's Waltz balance of power theory or Waltz balance of threat theory or Mearsheimer's offensive realism or offensive defense theory, offer normative guidelines for how states ought or ought not behave. They offer normative guidelines for the types of foreign policies that states ought to pursue. Does neoclassical realism offer a set of normative guidelines? It's something that I've struggled with for a number of years. Now, my inclination has always been to say, no, it doesn't. Neoclassical realism, as I conceive it, or rather the particular neoclassical realist theories that I have developed, don't necessarily offer a set of normative prescriptions for how any particular state ought or ought not behave. They're merely interested in explaining why they behave in the way that I observe them behaving. And that puts me in a somewhat uncomfortable position in the American Academy and in political science, particularly since there is an emphasis, at least among those of us on the Eastern Seaboard and major research universities, to develop theories which also have some policy relevance. Well, how can you have policy relevance if you are claiming to develop a theory which doesn't lead to normative prescriptions? Real dilemma for me. One that I haven't resolved. I'm not going to resolve it tonight. Try as I might. So, did I answer your question? No.
I would say you justify it on a different ground. It's a good justification, but it's still unsatisfying.
Well, we all have to live with disappointment. Remember, I hold a United States passport.
Right, no, behind you. The gentleman in the glasses first.
Yes, my name is Alexander Walash from the University of London. I wanted to ask you about what are the differences in the baseline predictions between your theory, neoclassical realism, and liberalism. And when I say liberalism, I have really in mind the two-step logic, the two-step approach that Jeffrey LeGros and Andrew Mravchuk organized in their own work. And it seems like there's some overlap, but they place things differently. Instead of taking the system as a cause and prior, they're thinking more in terms of domestic politics, preferences, so to speak. They still attach a lot of importance to external stimuli, but they talk in terms of intergovernmental bargaining. They're certainly much more attuned to international outcomes than other liberal scholars. So I can see the differences, but I wanted to wonder if you could talk a little more about why I should take your model as opposed to theirs.
I should say that Jeff LeGros is a friend of mine. Jeff LeGros is a friend of mine, and I think very highly of his work. And this is a debate which has been going on between us since 1999, when they published that piece in International Security, Is Anybody Still a Realist? And they claim in that article and in their subsequent work that there are particular classes of variables which are the sole prerogative of particular theoretical approaches, much to the consternation of many of us who are described as political realists. I don't think there is such a thing as a purely realist variable any more than I think there's such a thing as a purely constructivist variable or particularly liberal variable or particularly foreign policy analysis or English school variable. Because every school of international relations theory that has anything interesting to say about empirical phenomena borrows concepts and ideas from other schools of international relations theory. Indeed, the entire discipline of international relations, to paraphrase Robert Jervis, begs, borrows, and steals concepts from other social sciences, most notably economics. Where economics goes, political science follows. However, imperfectly, generally imperfectly. So I don't buy that particular argument. Now, as for their two-step approach to explaining foreign policy decision-making, they claim to begin with the international system, but they really don't. They pay lip service to it. They say, well, we're looking at external stimuli, but I'm really interested in intergovernmentalism, or I'm really interested in strategic culture, as LeGros defined it in his first book. That's what's doing the causing there. So I think that that's really a semantic distraction on their part. If you look at their work very carefully, they're ascribing almost all causal power to forces within the state in explaining the phenomena that they seek to explain. And that's just a fundamental, irresolvable disagreement that I'm going to have with them and with many of their students.
Yes, sir, you're the great gentleman.
Daniel Fair, IIMC at LSE. Thank you very much for your talk. My question pertains to the fact that it is essentially taking realism as a baseline, therefore statism as well. How do you account for non-state actors, supranational actors, if IR is simply a relation between states?
Well, we never say that IR is simply relations between states. We're quite clear about that. We acknowledge that there are consequential actors in the international environment that are not sovereign territorial states. And sovereignty, I know, is a legal principle. It's not an accurate statement, and there's some states that have always been more sovereign than others, and states which have enjoyed different degrees of sovereignty over time, different degrees of territoriality over time. But we never say that states are the only important actors or consequential actors in international politics. Neoclassical realism, as it has developed, and as we assume of it, is a state-centric body of foreign policy theory. In or about foreign policy theory and theories of international outcomes, in the last chapter of the book, we do speculate on some avenues for additional research. We talk about the role of international organizations and the role of international non-governmental organizations. But let's take, for instance, just for the sake of discussion and argument, the role of non-state actors, such as terrorist organizations or terrorist networks, or hacktivist collectives. What impact do they have in international politics? Well, just observe international politics, observe particular phenomena. They have some impact. They have quite a bit of impact in international politics. I would be a fool to deny that they don't have impact. The question is, how does one theorize about them? How does one acknowledge that they have impact while also acknowledging the reality that we still live in a world in which the state is the predominant form of political organization in the international political system? I think that there are some avenues to do neoclassical realist work in which one could develop a type of typology to try to discern when particular types of sub-state or non-state actors interacting with particular states are likely to have some consequential impact. I would welcome some of that work. I'm currently doing some work on cybersecurity as it pertains to the intelligence aspects of cybersecurity. It's not something which I've published on yet, something which I do hope to publish on sometime in the near future. But I've never said, nor have my co-authors ever said, that states are the only consequential actors.
Yes, the lady at the back.
Thank you for your talk. I'm just wondering, outside of neoclassical realism, what other theory or idea has most made you question your own interpretation, or on the flip side, sort of humbled your own research or sort of troubled your own research outside of neoclassical realism?
So you're asking me, you're asking me on November the 10th, 2016, what has humbled me? I mean, what something outside of my theoretical construct has really?
So then, outside of sort of what theory would have to sort of happen to make you think, oh God,
oh God, I've really got it wrong. Well, you know, we had this event in the United States 2 days ago. Perhaps you've heard about it. The presidential election. If that doesn't make one, if that doesn't shake one's faith in social science research, I'm not sure what had. There was a piece in The Guardian, which I do read occasionally, an editorial in The Guardian, which is, you know, the unthinkable is unthinkable until it happens. The unthinkable will happen in international politics, and it tends to happen on a fairly regular basis in international politics. There will be empirical anomalies for particular theories that I have developed, particular theories I will develop in the future. I think what we're pretty clear on, Nora and Stephen and I, the royal we, is that a particular anomaly or event does not invalidate the entire research program. We went through this debate about 25 years ago when the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed. And there were people in the academy on both sides of the Atlantic who argued that that sudden change, that particular set of events, which is actually far more complex than many IR journals or pieces published in IR journals at the time made it seem, somehow invalidated structural realism as an entire research program. And I thought that was just hubristic on the part of the critics of structural realism. On the other part, I also thought it was hubristic to focus exclusively on continuity, and they did point out some important limitations, which is that structural realism, as Waltz conceived of it, was very good at explaining continuity and not particularly good at explaining sharp discontinuity. But I would argue very few social science theories are good at explaining sharp discontinuities, explaining the so-called black swans in international politics. There will always be empirical anomalies for particular theories. Now, I'd like to turn your question around, if I can, and argue, make an observation about, you know, what has influenced my thinking about international politics quite a bit. One book which I think every potential IR theorist, regardless of his or her theoretical supposition, but particularly if they're interested in systemic rule of theory, ought to read is Robert Jervis's 1996 book, Systems Effects. I never worked with Jervis as a graduate student. I didn't do my doctoral work at Columbia University. I didn't meet Jervis until after I had tenure at Tufts University. But that book, which I read, had a profound effect on my thinking about how systems operate and about how complex systems are and about the role of feedback. And so I highly recommend that particular book. And Jervis, well, he doesn't identify as a neoclassical realist, but you can certainly see the influence of that book in chapter 2 of Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics, and we cite him repeatedly.
Okay.
Yes, you, sir.
Thank you. I'm Goitom from University of Cambridge, and thank you for your very stimulating talk.
Thank you for coming from Cambridge.
Okay. I have a question. I wonder where the rival literature fits into your theory of neoclassical realism. The rival literature, because you talk here about, or you account for the three levels of analysis. You have the systemic, the individual, the state, but the rival literature focuses on interaction. And you talked about feedback loops, and I'm thinking interaction is a different sort of explanatory factor, and that has a great deal of empirical evidence too, supporting it. So that's my first question. My second question, you said that a single event does not disqualify a theory. But how would you respond to or react to quantitative data such as that presented by Pinker, which shows that interstate wars have been declining quite significantly? How would that feed into your claims about systemic causes?
Okay, thank you for your questions. Let me answer the second one first, which was Steven Pinker and the decline of war thesis. It's a very influential, somewhat controversial book. And I would note that in that book he conflates, he's talking about the decline of violence, not just the decline of interstate war, and he manages to aggregate everything from the declining incidence of the alleged declining incidence of interstate warfare and intra-state warfare all the way down to the decline in instances of domestic violence in particular societies, which is a very dubious proposition on a whole range of issues. It's a very selective reading of history. It's also something which some of my quantitative friends, in particular Bear Brohmeyer at Ohio State University, take strong exception to for a variety of methodological reasons. That what Pinker is purporting to show, that there is this great movement toward a more peaceful type of social interaction among human beings at every conceivable level of analysis over the past 1,000 years, is not only based upon faulty empirical analysis, it's based upon very sloppy methodology, very sloppy research. So I am very dubious about the whole decline of violence, decline of war types of theorizing. I think every few years, some scholar or public intellectual comes out with a book that claims that we're moving towards a more peaceful, less conflictual world, and that human civilization is gradually evolving towards some grand utopia. 25 years ago, this was the thesis of Francis Fukuyama and the end of history and the last man. book. Earlier, it was somebody else. The most infamous example was Norman Angell and Peace of Illusions work before the Second World War, so I dispute that. The first question, I think, is a very interesting one. I am not a quantitative IR scholar. I never have been. I don't have the training. I appreciate the contributions of quantitative IR, but I do not do it. I do not have the skill set. That said, the literature on enduring rivalries between pairs of states, the notion of enduring rivalries, and how pairs of states or even groups of states within a particular region interact with one another, and how the aggregation of their interactions can shape the dynamics of interstate politics within a particular region, that's precisely the types of phenomena that would fall within the purview of type 3 neoclassical realism, as I conceive of it. I'll talk very briefly about an interstate rivalry that I've studied peripherally to my own work, which is the rivalry between India and Pakistan. Now, this is clearly an enduring rivalry by anyone's definition, close to 70 years, 6 wars, 5 crises, which came this close to erupting into full-scale war. And it's a rivalry in which both sides are not only trying to anticipate what the other side is doing next, but their the range of possible strategies that the foreign policy executives in Islamabad and New Delhi can pursue at any given time are not only shaped by the domestic political conditions within India and Pakistan, they're also delimited to a certain extent by the types of strategies that their predecessors had adopted 5 years earlier, 10 years earlier, 25 years earlier, 75 years earlier. That's precisely the type of research that I think neoclassical realism ought to adopt. Indeed, an example of neoclassical realist research which does try to do that is Vipin Narang's book, Nuclear Strategy in the Modern Age. Although his dependent variable is the nuclear posture of emerging nuclear states, France, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. His work also has implications in the case of India and Pakistan for the dynamics of their rivalry, since the types of choices that they pursued with respect to their particular nuclear research and then nuclear weapons and their ballistic missiles and their conventional armament decisions over time were the result of that type of strategic interaction. So have I answered your question?
Right. Last two questions, there and there, both together and very short.
Okay, going into your slide on the lives of neoclassical realism, I would argue that there's a direct relation between the systemic level of analysis and the temporal level. So the more systemic, the more time is able to explain. I have two simple questions. Would you say that there is an indirect relation between those two, between this direct relation and the role of intervening variables, meaning that the more time, a more systemic explanation, the less intervening variables can explain? And the second question would be, and if that's like that, can intervening variables can be conceived as more of an independent variables in the short term, like in type 1 neoclassical realism? So can domestic considerations explain particular foreign policy events if we only take type 1 neoclassical realism?
Again, let me begin with the second part of your question first. If you're arguing that the causal primacy of domestic level intervening variables, the domestic level variables, they're doing the causing. If you are arguing that they are the cause of observable behavior, then that's not neoclassical realism. That's an innenpolitique school of theorizing. That would fall within the foreign policy analysis literature. And there's nothing wrong with being a proponent of foreign policy analysis, proposing an innenpolitique theory of international politics. I don't do it myself, but there's nothing wrong with that. With respect to the second part, or your first part of your question, which is about the relationship between these intervening variables and the temporal element. Well, on the previous slide, I said that, look, as one moves out in time from explaining short-term crisis behavior to longer-term patterns of foreign policy behavior and grand strategic adjustments, then different categories of intervening variables are more likely to be consequential. So the answer to your first question is, in a sense, no. That over time, yes, of course, the system is going to perpetuate itself in some way, shape, or form, but we would expect different types of intervening variables to be of greater interest, to be of greater import in trying to explain the strategic responses of particular states than other classes of intervening variables. Did that address your question?
Final question.
Yeah, hi, my name is Sam. I'm doing a master's at Kiara School. Looking at this slide, the one on both sides, I'm just, those kinetic variables that you mentioned, they seem like a description of reality, like a description of accurate of what happens in real life. I can't see the theoretical dimension. And since there's no way to get into a leader's head yet, or gauge a state society and their dynamics or links, how is this model useful?
It's theoretical in the sense that we're specifying the parameters under which those particular categories of variables are more likely to play a role in this causal equation. We are admittedly limited because we're dealing with or theorizing about linear relationships and theorizing basing our models on linear relationships, recognizing full well that politics as it exists in the real world, is simply not linear. If we're positing a circular model, will we be accused of tautology? So we're beginning with the assumption that, well, we can try to model politics, informally model politics, in terms of a linear algebraic equation. Now we begin each of our categories of intervening variables with certain types of assumptions, or rather borrow these categories of intervening variables from other schools of theory, which posit them as primarily causal. We're saying that they are best intervening. Yes, you're right. What's the relationship between theory and reality? We're not, and one of the things I think that distinguished neoclassical realism from the outset from other schools of international relations theories, in particular structural realism, but also constructivism and neoliberal institutionalism, was the fact that it was trying to explain discrete phenomena with respect to variables, intervening level variables that could be more easily identified or measured. But, be that as it may, in international politics, any variable that's going to be of interest to anyone is going to be difficult to measure. It's going to be difficult to, loathe this verb, operationalize.
I was going to use it, but I
just loathe it. Loathe that word, operationalize. It's one of those words I just dislike. Just like if you ever fly domestically in the United States, you never get off an airplane, you deplane.
Deplane?
What does that make? Or immiserate. That's another word that I can't believe. Immiserate? Oh, it's going to immiserate. We can continue this conversation later because I think we are running out of time, thank God.
Excellent. Well, first I'd like to thank the audience for coming this evening and for staying so late and asking a series of really perceptive questions. But more importantly, we need to thank Jeff for a superb talk, incredibly focused, very clear, and also I think he did a great job in selling the new book, A Neoclassical Realist Theory of International Politics, which I would suggest if you haven't rushed out to buy, you must. Thank you very much.